Matter of East Orange Educational Support Professionals Association and Maintenance Association versus the East Orange Board of Ed. Will we please have appearances of counsel?
Sanford L. Rockshell is appearing on behalf of both positions.
Good morning, Ramon E. Rivera from the law firm of Antonelli Quincy Rivera, on behalf of the East Orange Public School District. I'm going to have a partner, Madeline Hicks, who's on the group.
Good morning, Attorney General, on behalf of Meekness, Attorney General.
Good morning, counsel. Please know that Justice Pierre-Louis will be participating in this case. She's going to be watching the live stream. And we will go till around 12:30. I doubt, but you may surprise us, that we'll complete the argument by then. And if not, we'll take a brief recess for lunch to accommodate staff, and we'll be back to complete it. Mr. Rockstone.
Well, the good news for you, Your Honor, in terms of the time schedule, is nobody speaks faster than I do. So you have a good chance of making the 12:30 break. In preparing for the argument today, the first thing I did, obviously, is read the arbitrator's award. And the Board of Education made the argument about the impact of the statute, as it should have made before the arbitrator. And the arbitrator ruled in my favor. I then went to the trial court, the Chancery Division in Essex County, to confirm the award. In opposition, the Board of Education argued, as it should have, the impact of that statute. The Chancery judge, and I might add in my opinion anyway, that no judge in the state is more familiar with the standards of arbitration awards than Chancery judges who uniformly face confirmation cases. That Chancery judge in Essex County, Judge Apter, ruled that the arbitrator's decision was much more than reasonably debatable. Much more, so it didn't apply the reasonably debatable standard. It was correct. Again, speaking for the Chancery judge, here the award is based on the contract language and is not contrary to any law, regulation, or precedent. And I did not find there are any public policy grounds which have been articulated upon which it should be vacated. So I won in the Chancery division. My thought was, how did the appellate division go so far astray? And my first place looking for that was obviously the statute in question. Relevant part of that statute, public school employees covered by a collective negotiations agreement shall be entitled to compensation, benefits, and emoluments as provided in the collective negotiations agreement, as if the school facilities remained open for any purpose, and I'm emphasizing this with the and. Any way you want, and is a very important word, and I'm going to get back to that in a minute. And for any time lost as a result of school closures or use of virtual remote instruction. Well, custodians are not covered by the statute because of the word and there, and you can't be a custodian and work remotely. You have to be in school to work in the school buildings, cleaning them up. So this statute, which says, should remain open for any purpose and for any time lost as a result of school closures or virtual instruction, simply it doesn't address custodians whatsoever. So how did this thing develop into such a case that's now in front of the Supreme Court when it's pretty easily decided? Remember, in your Reese Rutherford case, you said that the reasonably debatable standard, it really is it plausible? Is the arbitrator's award plausible? Is the arbitrator's construction plausible? An arbitrator and a chancery judge ruled on my behalf, and the appellate division never addressed that, but in essence found that those two decisions weren't even plausible? That's mind-boggling. So how do we get there? I then looked at the petition, this court's granting of our petition. And the statement, and I don't know how official this is, I don't know who puts this in writing, I'm not sure anybody's bound by it, but I looked at it. The issue to be decided today was the arbitrator's decision that the East Orange Board of Education violated the collective bargaining agreement with its custodial employees when it ceased paying them extra compensation for reporting for work when schools were closed for COVID-19, reasonably debatable in light of the statute. Now, this is what you said, paren, providing that during a state of emergency, school employees shall be compensated, quote, as if the school facilities remained open, end quote. There's no and. So when, the very statute that we're, that you articulate, they identify as being the subject of the scrutiny here, and the second clause.
Are you reading from the website or from the
website.
When, okay.
And that's why I don't know how official it is. I just look at it.
We don't want to interrupt your 5 minutes, but I wouldn't spend time on that.
Okay. Well, but I would spend time on the appellate division decision, though, because that does the exact same issue. On page 18 of the slip opinion, the appellate division says the statute, every time it's a long statute, we all know which statute I'm referring to, is unequivocal. And it cites the statute and it ends. As if school facilities remained open for any purpose. Three dots. No and. And I had argued repeatedly that the statute was intended only for professional staff who could work remotely, because that's what the and says. It's worse than that. I this may be harsh, and it is harsh, but for 10 years I taught at Rutgers Law School as an adjunct professor on employment discrimination. I would have failed if anybody submitted this to me. Look again at page 19 of the slip opinion, starting on bottom of page 18. Whereas here, the COVID-19 state of emergency, school facilities are closed for more than 3 school days. School employees are to be compensated pursuant to the terms of the CBA, quote, quote, as if the school facilities remained open for any purpose, period, period, end quote. There's no period here. The statute says and. The appellate division put a period, end quote, citing the very statute that it purported to rely upon and miscited the statute.
What are you arguing is the meaning of the words and for any time lost? That's the words that you're saying the appellate division ignored, correct?
Well, for any time lost, the result of school closures. So clearly, listen, you can't criticize the legislature here too much. There was an emergency and that they did the best they could to cover as many bases as they could in a short period of time. And this was the fear that schools were not going to reach the 180-day threshold, that they may, because remote teaching and not going to school, the statutes require 180 days. Maybe the teachers would only teach 130 days. This statute was clearly time lost as a result of school closures. School closures didn't impact custodians whatsoever. This statute has no impact by its own terms. And that's why the appellate division, for any purpose, period, is just a mischaracterization of the statute.
Why? I am missing the argument as to why that language after the and changes the result. Are you saying the appellate division would be right if the sentence stopped where they put a period?
It might be the appellate division might have a better argument that the arbitrator's decision was not plausible. But when the statute says for any time lost as a result of school closures or the use of virtual remote instruction, it's not an or, it's an and.
So what's the meaning? That's why I'm asking. What is the meaning of that phrase?
That meaning of that phrase is that if any teacher can't teach 180 days, if any teacher, I forget what it is now, you have to have 4 hours a day. I forget what constitutes a day for the 180 day criteria. But because of remote teaching, because of COVID, if the teacher couldn't teach the requisite number of hours, the teacher still get paid.
So this is just, in your view, about if a teacher would not be able to be in school physically present teaching for 180 days, this means that they will still get paid.
Yes.
So then what is the meaning of the last phrase, except that additional compensation, comma, benefits, comma, and emoluments may be negotiated for additional work performed?
That's a good question, because I have no idea what that means. And I'll tell you why. I'm not saying that facetiously. That sentence that you just referred to, Your Honor, is in the future sense, future tense. Except that additional compensation benefits amounts may be negotiated. May be negotiated. It's a future tense. Does that mean that for the teachers, if they're going to be working remotely, but they still need somebody to drive a kid to the a student to the debate club, that is additional compensation and benefits for additional work performed. That situation that had not applied before COVID.
Legislature, Mr. Oxfeld, absolutely knows how to limit statutes to teachers. There are more statutes in our statute book that apply only to teachers than I could possibly count. Am I right about that?
Correct.
They know how they have a definition, and they know how to limit the certain provisions, be it tenure, the whole gamut of provisions that apply to teachers. This does not have that limitation. Is it your argument that this only applies to teachers, not to any other school employees?
It applies to any school employee who is capable of working virtually or working remote.
And where is that limitation found in the statute?
After the end. And for any time lost as a result of school closures or use of virtual remote instruction.
So let's go.
I will go a step further, Your Honor. I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
You can finish.
I'll go a step further. The appellate division not only mischaracterized the statute, put a period, end quote, when there was no such thing whatsoever. The court never got involved in the preemption doctrine. And that's the state supervisory cases and a local 195 case, Bernard's case, that are all in our briefs, not Bethlehem case, in our briefs.
Let's go back to the statutory language that you're focusing on, but begin with a few clauses before. It says, the legislation says, public school employees covered by a collective negotiations agreement. It doesn't say teachers. Isn't that a broader concept than the one you're advancing?
But that the first clause clearly is broader.
And that's all part and parcel of the language that you read for us.
Yes, but it's talking about public employees who, when schools remained open, and who lost time result of school closure. Yes, it's any public employee who lost time result of a school closure or virtual remote instruction. That's what it says. So it's any public employee who falls into that category. And custodians don't fall into that category.
What does it mean to lose time?
Well, I think what the goal was, you don't meet the 180 days.
It's all about the 180 days.
Or the length of a school day. I think it's 4 hours constitutes a day to qualify for the 180 day threshold. And so because of some mishap on the computer and they couldn't do 4 hours remote instruction, they only did 3 hours, that they wouldn't count. But they still get paid under that statute because it was.
Where in the statute does it say this is what this is about? We see in these statutes a lot of explanation as to what category is being addressed. Where does it say that this statute is limited to the circumstances that you say it is limited to?
I'm just repeating myself. The word "and" for any time lost as a result of school closures.
I think the reason we're having trouble understanding
it. I would turn it around.
I think the reason we're having trouble understanding it seems like you're moving that language.
I really can't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. I think it seems like you're moving that language to modify not the as if the school facilities remained open for any purpose, but instead to modify the word public school employees. So it seems like you're kind of reading the statute to say for any public school employees covered by collective negotiations agreements who lose time as a result of school closures or the use of virtual or remote instruction, they shall be entitled to compensation as provided in the agreement as if the school facilities remained open. But it doesn't actually say that. So where are you understanding that based on how the words are currently written and in the order in which they currently appear, only employees who lose time because of the virtual 4-hour limit that you were referring to are covered here?
Respectfully, the question you ask me reads out of the statute anything after "and." The way you're asking the question, what does the word and that phrase after "and" mean? It's like the appellate division's period, end quote.
Help us out. Please answer the question.
Yeah.
Even if you disagree with it.
The only interpretation of this statute giving meaning to every phrase in the statute is the one I'm urging on you, that, and for any time lost, any public school employee gets benefits as if the schools remained open for any time lost as a result of school closures or use of virtual remote instruction. There's no other interpretation of this statute that gives meaning to every clause and phrase in that statute. And I maintain the appellate division recognized that by falsely putting down a period end quote when it's claimed to cite the statute. And there's the other issue, getting back to the preemption doctrine. For a statute to preempt a collective bargaining agreement in Bethlehem, in Local 195 IFPTE, this court held, when legislature intends to override rights established through collective negotiations agreement, it must do so expressively, specifically, and comprehensively. I would argue, therefore, the vagaries, and clearly they exist in the statute, have to be interpreted in favor of the unions, because the burden.
But if you're talking about Local 195, preemption had a very different meaning, respectfully, and that was whether a subject is non-negotiable. That's what it meant in Local 195.
Not at all, Your Honor. Respectfully, not at all. In Ridgefield Park, the Supreme Court, this court, said that if something is non-negotiable, it can't be put in a collective bargaining agreement. In Local 195, quite to the contrary, it said if there's a statute that preempts, there are two different grounds for something not being negotiable. One is a term and condition of employment versus management prerogative. That is Ridgefield Park. To the contrary, the Local 195 case and the Bethlehem case both stand for the proposition that for a statute to preempt negotiations, that statute must do so expressively, specifically, and comprehensively. The statute must.
Is it your contention that the issue in this case is whether these subject matters are non-negotiable, or given the public health crisis that occurred and a myriad of statutes that covered virtually all aspect of employment and life in New Jersey during the COVID period, that the legislature clearly wanted to provide for a payment or a level of payment that it considered to be appropriate for the situation that was encountered by schools and school employees, including those that you whom you represent.
So yes, I think so.
What I'm saying is preemption the right term here?
Well, we argued it was. The Attorney General's brief doesn't use the word preemption. It uses the word, I can find that.
The Attorney General talked about clarity in the legislative statement, but preemption is a term of art. Would you agree with me on that?
I would. And there's no evidence that this statute was meant to preempt any term and condition of the collective bargaining agreement affecting the custodians, the blue collar workers in East Orange. The Attorney General's brief uses the word, the arbitrator's award of premium pay must be vacated because the statute unambiguously supersedes.
Yeah.
Well, there's no difference in my mind between supersedes and preempts.
Can I ask a question? If there was collective bargaining agreement that provided that different school employees were to earn different amounts of money and it was set forth for, you know, in great detail, and then all of a sudden the legislature passed a statute that said all teachers who have already taught for 10 years shall earn $100,000 a year, would that preempt whatever amount the teachers were, as long as the legislature said, and this applies immediately? Are you arguing that would preempt whatever the collective bargaining agreement had said about how much those teachers should be paid?
I'm not arguing that. I'm acknowledging that if the statute was specific and comprehensive and said precisely what you said, Your Honor, that would meet the standard set forth in Local 195 in Bethlehem.
So then what is not specific about this statute in that it says public school employees shall be paid as if schools were open?
For any time lost as a result of a school closure. I don't know how else I can say that. There's a second clause here, and it's, I heard the argument in the previous case. Here's an and, Your Honor, you're talking about the or in the interpretation of the—
I think we don't understand what your argument is as to what happens after the and that matters. That's why we're asking.
I'm gonna say something again. I think you understand that you may disagree with me respectfully, but this statute only applies to public employees who have lost time as a result of school closures. Because there's an and there.
You're saying that's only teachers.
There may be some administrators, but certainly not blue-collar workers who must go to— I mean, there's a real world here. These custodians went to work every day during COVID.
But sure. Here, the statute, sorry, was amended on April 14th, 2020, right?
Not amended, it was enacted, but yes.
And so, based on the way you're phrasing it, it seems like it only applies to people who had already lost time. If you would lose time after April 14th, 2020, then it doesn't apply to you?
No, if you think that's my argument, that's not my argument. I think the final sentence talks about the future. May be negotiated. I think the phrase may be talks in the future tense. But listen, if it were not for the word and, I think that there's a good argument that perhaps the arbitrator's award was not appropriately confirmed, that it was not feasible, whatever word that you've used. But with that and there, and again, I mean this with all respect, the Supreme Court's argument, thought about what that statute means, is not really important.
I'm sorry?
It's what the Supreme Court thinks that statute means is not really important. Is it at least arguable that the arbitrator's decision and the decision of the trial court is appropriate? We negotiated for an arbitrator's decision.
If the court concludes that the arbitration award contravened the statute, you're saying it doesn't matter what we think of it?
The issue for you, respectfully, and it's, again, I know the Chief Justice told me don't pay too much attention to the grant of certification, but the issue that you identified is, was the arbitrator's award reasonably debatable?
No. The order granting certification says certification is granted. You're working off the website as though that's binding on the court. That's not an avenue I suggest.
Okay, but I do think the appropriate inquiry here is in light of East Rutherford and in light of a whole bunch of cases that have come before and after that, in which this court has repeatedly said the court is not to substitute its judgment for that of the arbitrator. So the only issue, as far as I'm concerned, before this court is whether the arbitrator's decision is feasible. Is it reasonably debatable? You may come to it. I mean, I was in the appellate division 2 months ago in an unreported decision out of Robbinsville. And the trial court and the appellate court both said to me, if this had come before us on first impression, you might have been right. But we cannot say the arbitrator's decision was not reasonably debatable. And that's the issue. The issue is not, with all due respect, what you think the statute says. The issue is there a reasonably debatable interpretation adopted by the arbitrator and by the trial court in this matter? And I maintain, respectfully, Your Honor, that although you may not agree with my and applying to public school employees as a generic class, and therefore only those who are working remotely get the benefit of the statute, you may not agree with that.
Was that the argument that the arbitrator made?
It's the argument the trial court made. The arbitrator said he thought it created a base, but not a limit on top.
The arbitrator said something different from that.
The arbitrator said it created a base.
So the issue is whether that the arbitrator was correct in the arbitrator's determination, correct? Not someone else's interpretation of it, but whether the arbitrator's conclusion was reasonably debatable. And I respectfully didn't see in the arbitrator's award the argument that you're now making.
No, I made it to the appellate court. I did not make it to the arbitrator. The argument I made to the arbitrator is precisely the argument I'm trying to also articulate now as a second ground, which is the preemption doctrine. Because as was stated before, if a statute said teachers must get paid $100,000 without preempt, the answer, yes. But then there's I know we're getting far astray, but then there's something called partial preemption. The typical example of partial preemption is sick leave. Teachers are guaranteed 10 sick days a year. You can negotiate as much more than that as you want to. The preemption sets a bottom, does not establish the top. In the hypothetical, you gave about $100,000. I'd have to look at the legislation, the hypothetical legislation, but would that set both the bottom and the top, or would it just be the bottom and we could negotiate more than $100,000? We'd have to look at that under the preemption doctrine set forth by the Supreme Court in the Local 195 case.
But that is
and that all, was the, I'm sorry.
That's all about what the statute says. So even for sick leave, for example, if the legislature were to pass a law that says teachers are only entitled to 10 days of sick leave and everyone shall receive 10 days of sick leave, then that's setting both a floor and a ceiling, correct?
Absolutely correct. But the argument I made to the arbitrator was the preemption argument, which is that this statute does not preempt the contract language. It does not speak specifically in everything I've said earlier. And therefore, and the arbitrator bought that argument.
So the arbitrator specifically in referring to the statute said, even less clear is the legislature's authority to invalidate my jurisdiction, which springs from the party's agreement to interpret and render an award based solely on that agreement, correct?
Well, that was a separate sentence that had nothing to do with the, when he found the statute, he found the statute, set a base, but not a top. He
well,
said that
he follows that sentence,
yeah,
right?
Correct.
Okay,
correct.
So you agree that that's incorrect, right?
No, I don't. I never said it's incorrect.
So you're saying the legislature does not have authority to preempt a collective bargaining agreement ever?
I said, no, if it speaks comprehensively and directly that it is overriding the collective bargaining agreement.
But no, here the arbitrator seems to say the legislature, even less clear, is the legislature's authority to invalidate my jurisdiction. You just agreed the legislature obviously does have authority to invalidate the arbitrator's jurisdiction. Whether or not they exercise that authority is a separate question, right?
Yes. In the perfect world, and I don't mean to criticize the board attorney in this case because he's represented his client wonderfully throughout, but in a perfect world, the arbitrator's thought is exactly correct about his obligation to interpret the collective bargaining agreement. And the reason I say that, in a perfect world, the Board of Education would have filed, in light of the 195 case that we discussed, and even the Ridgefield Park case, what's called a scope of negotiations petition at PERC. PERC is the body with expertise to determine what's negotiable and what's not negotiable, what statute preempts and what statute does not preempt.
So you view this entire question as one of whether it's within the scope of negotiations?
Absolutely correct. And there's nothing in this statute, the way it's drafted, that preempts the negotiations, and the arbitrator's interpretation, as well as the trial court's interpretation, is ultimately correct. But at worst, it's reasonably debatable.
But don't you think the introduction of the text does that by excluding subsection E, when it specifically says nothing shall preempt these other sections, but doesn't apply that to subsection E?
I understand what you're saying, that nothing in subsections B, C, or D.
Right.
Those went entirely different issues. This.
But it's being very specific. It's being very specific about where preemption does or does not apply. It says preemption does apply to these other sections, but it specifically leaves out subsection E.
Yes. Yes, there's nothing in subsection E that I read.
No, but it's the opposite, isn't it? So the actual sentence says nothing in subsection B, C, or D mm-hmm. shall be construed to preempt.
Mm-hmm.
But because E is not included, that means that the legislature believes that E is construed to preempt.
And it preempts, as I stated, rights for teachers. It grants them more rights. But it does not preempt anything for those who have to report for work during COVID in person on a daily basis, jeopardizing their health and safety. And that's why we negotiate an emergency pay provision. And that's why the word and makes this and the clause that follows makes the arbitrator's decision and the trial court's decision at worst reasonably debatable.
So if you were here representing the NJEA and it's members who are teachers, you wouldn't even be making this argument.
Mr. Friedman will make the answer that he's doing. I won't speak for Mr. Friedman.
Right.
I've learned over the years not to do that.
But you would be saying that this, that teachers are the subject matter of this statute, and you, I understand your careful language, but you're saying that's a strong argument on behalf of the board. So as far as you're concerned, for your clients, this entire issue turns on whether we view subsection E to be limited to teachers or not. Am I right about that?
Whether you view an interpretation contrary to that as being reasonably debatable. Again, with all due respect, your goal, your charge from the decisions you have made in East Rutherford and all the Kearney PBA, we didn't negotiate for the court's interpretation of a statute. We negotiated for an arbitrator's interpretation for a statute. And in Ridgefield Park, in East Rutherford, you specifically said, as long as the arbitrator's interpretation of the statute is reasonably debatable, it will be affirmed.
So, an award is reasonably debatable if what? Give me the definition of reasonably debatable.
Well, I think if
the court concludes that the statute has been misconstrued, why is that not tantamount to a conclusion that the law does not support the award, and therefore the award should not be sustained?
If you find, and I don't think there's any basis in the statute or in the trial court decision, but if you find that the trial court decision and the arbitrator's award is not, quote, plausible, and that's the word that this court has used repeatedly, equating that to reasonably debatable. If you find that's not plausible, then I guess you have to vacate the award.
Mr. Oxfield, if the statute is open to two reasonable interpretations and the arbitrator chooses one, isn't that within the realm of reasonably debatable?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's my grounds. I agree with that entirely. I couldn't have said it better myself.
In this case, the public health emergency. So the public health emergency was terminated on March 4th, 2022, correct?
I think it was July 4th, March 4th.
I have the public health emergency being terminated on March 4th, 2022. My question was just, when were these benefits required, the 2.5 times in your view,
I don't have that in front of me, but yes, from the date the governor declared a state of emergency to the date the governor declared that there was no longer a state of emergency, that whatever that time period is.
Even though after July 4th, 2021, all of the schools were reopened and teachers were present in person as well.
The statute still applied because the contract says that these people get paid, the blue collar workers get paid a premium pay for working in dangerous circumstances, working during COVID. As long as there's a state of emergency declared by the governor, that the teachers may have gone back into school, may have obviated the second part of because they're no longer working remotely. But as long as there's a state of emergency still declared by the governor, the contract language governs, which says that as long as there's a state of emergency declared by the governor, they get premium pay.
And is that the amount that was actually paid? I know there's some.
I think we're halfway. We've been arguing about that forever. We've had a second arbitrator apply what the damages are. I think that it's about half paid. I think half remains unpaid, and half was paid. That's just my guess. I'll defer to whatever Mr. Rivera says about that.
So let me ask you something. You answered the chief's question by saying that if the statute's open to two reasonable interpretations and the arbitrator chooses one, is that reasonably debatable? Yes, that was your answer. The arbitrator did not adopt the interpretation that you are telling us that we should adopt. We should look to what the arbitrator did, correct, to see whether there was a reasonable interpretation of the statute.
Respectfully, I don't think that's the standard. I think you look what the appellate division did
And of course, we're reviewing the appellate division's determination. But when you look at the reasonably debatable standard, you're looking at, was the arbitrator's interpretation of the statute reasonably debatable? Now, there is an interpretation of the statute in the arbitration award, but it's not the one that's based upon that and language that you're citing to us here. It is, as I'm just looking at my notes on it, it says that the schools were closed for purposes of the CBA because they were closed for the purpose it's supposed to serve, and that subsection 9 did not render the schools open because it was intended to protect bargain unit employees from losses, not additional pay, sustained during closures longer than 3 days. And then the arbitrator went on to make the comment that Justice Wiener Apter quoted about the legislature cannot divest me, the arbitrator, of some of my jurisdiction or invalidate my jurisdiction, which springs from the parties' agreements. That's what we need to determine whether it was reasonable, correct?
Yes, and I also remember I made the argument about preemption, and that's what the arbitrator accepted, that there was no preemption.
I understand
that. I made that argument to the trial court.
In terms of the interpretation of the statute that we should look at, mm-hmm. It's not the trial courts, it's not the appellate divisions, it's not any of the counsel's interpretations that we should look at. That's not what reasonably debatable is about. It's about the arbitrator's reasoning, correct?
If the arbitrator's award is reasonably debatable, right. Not his reasoning.
Well, his interpretation of the statute.
Well, that's a very, very interesting argument or discussion. There's wonderful language, I hope I can find it, in the famous paintball case. Are you familiar with the paintball? Was any of you on the court when the paintball case was? Justice Cazale was the Chief Justice.
No.
It's a great case. It's one of the fun cases to discuss. Attendant on the turnpike got mad at somebody who went through the booth, got into his truck and followed that person and got a paintball gun and started shooting that person with paintball pellets. And the police stopped him and he was convicted of some sort of the crime of shooting, some sort of crime, I don't know what it was. And the turnpike authority fired him. And the case went to arbitration and the arbitrator said that he's been out of work for 10 months and I think that's a sufficient penalty, I'm putting him back. And the trial court said, no, this is violating the statute, and therefore it's contrary to public policy. He was convicted of whatever that was. The appellate division said, no, he violated a statute. He should be terminated, it's against public policy. The Chief Justice said, anyway, it's New Jersey Turnpike Authority versus Local 196, 190 NJ 283, at pages 300 to 301. We hold that the public policy exception and Weiss's, the Weiss case, heightened judicial scrutiny of awards are triggered when a labor arbitration award, the award, violates a clear mandate of public policy. The award. So the Chief Justice, I think it was speaking for unanimous court in that case, said there's nothing in violation of public policy putting an employee back to work. That's what the arbitrator found. Putting him back to work is not a violation of public policy. Applying that to this case, there's no violation of public policy telling custodians who had to work during COVID, when their collective bargaining agreement says you get paid emergency pay for working during COVID, that they're going to get emergency pay.
I thought we were talking about the reasonably debatable standard. What does that apply to? It has nothing to do with the reasoning of the arbitrator.
That's not New Jersey Turnpike Authority case. It's the award of the arbitrator.
That was the statutory public policy exception. Was it not?
The claim in that case was because the shooter of the paintballs was convicted of a crime. The criminal statute was public policy, and that because he was convicted, the public policy was violated by the arbitrator putting him back to work. And that was soundly rejected. I think it was by unanimous court per Chief Justice Cazale.
Other questions, anyone? Counselor, is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, thank you. Clearly you paid attention. Thank you very much.
Mr. Friedman, why don't we start your argument? We'll probably break at 12:30, but let's begin.
Thank you, I appreciate that. So may it please the court.
The issue seems to be settling down to whether the award was reasonably debatable, which was always the issue. And that's how you interpret the statute, whether the statute included the remedy that the arbitrator afforded. And I'm perfectly comfortable with Justice Patterson's statement of what did the arbitrator say. What the arbitrator said, purpose would appear to be to protect bargaining unit employees from losses, not additional pay. That being said, there's nothing in here in the statute, in the language or the purpose, at least nothing significant, that says that they couldn't get paid more. And actually, the law is actually the opposite, as I'll tell you in a moment. The standard is a reasonable debatable under the East Rutherford decision. Questions of law, in other words, what does the statute mean, and questions of public policy are for the arbitrator. And the term reasonable debatable was defined in the East Rutherford case as meaning is it in direct conflict with the statute.
And you said there's nothing in the statute to suggest that they couldn't be paid more. What about the phrase at the end, except that additional compensation, benefits, and emoluments may be negotiated for additional work performed?
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, that's a little bothersome, but it's not a prohibition. And what you need in order for preemption or in order to prevent them from negotiating more is you need specific language. You need a prohibition. And I'm going to go back to the state versus state supervisory case, which is almost 50 years old, and it's been the law for the last 50 years, and we're appealing all these cases. And it makes it very clear, not only does preemption apply whether you can talk about this, but preemption applies whether when there is a statute, whether that statute prohibits additional compensation or additional things. And I'm going to read from the case, because it's very clear. Thus, where statute or regulation—
Can you give us a site?
The site? Sure, it's 78 New Jersey at page 54, but it's page 81 and 82 is what I'm reading from. And it says, thus, where statute or regulation mandates a minimum level of rights or benefits for public employees, but does not bar the public employer from choosing to afford them greater protection, proposals by the employees to obtain that greater protection in a negotiated agreement are mandatory and negotiable. A contractual provision according to the employee's rights or benefits in excess of that required by statute or regulation is valid and enforceable. And what we have here is a statute which required a certain minimum level of benefits, but did not in any place prohibit additional benefits.
Why is that true, though, in terms of the last phrase? Doesn't the last phrase imply that additional compensation can be paid for additional work performed, but
yes,
not for
but it
the...
doesn't prohibit additional compensation if the parties agree without forcing the board or anybody else to agree to additional compensation in the circumstances, especially working in hazardous conditions, which is sort of tantamount to additional work.
But then why would they then use the word accept?
I have to look at that language if you bear with me. It's not the most artful phrase, but what I would submit is they were aware of state. They would have to make very clear that you can't do this. And this language is not clear enough. And in fact, the right to negotiate it would exist in the PERC Act regardless of this.
What is the meaning of the phrase? And I'm skipping over the part that talks about the public health emergency. And I think there's no dispute that that language applies. Quote, public school employees covered by a collective negotiations agreement shall be entitled to compensation, benefits, and emoluments as provided in the collective negotiations agreement as if the school facilities remain open for any purpose. I know there's more. We'll get to that. But what does that mean?
That means they're entitled to this, but it doesn't mean they can't negotiate for that. And in fact, the agreement provided for emergency pay, provided for pay in circumstances of emergencies before this ever occurred.
But it didn't say anything. Of course, the agreement didn't say anything about COVID because it was signed long before COVID, right?
Correct. So you could actually say that the agreement provided for this and you're enforcing the agreement when they're paid for going in the emergency. So actually, that takes you back to the agreement, and the agreement provided for this. Nobody negotiated anything extra when this occurred. They had already negotiated this. It was in the agreement.
Does the language that we just went over cover situations where virtual teaching is being done and a school is physically closed? Is that what it could be referring to?
If it only covers virtual agreements, and that was one of the, virtual teaching, and that was one of my thoughts, then it doesn't even apply to people who goes in school, come into school, and the agreement doesn't preempt at all. Doesn't even, I'm sorry, the statute doesn't preempt. Statute doesn't even apply, and there's no basis to set aside the arbitrator's decision on that basis. But if you go back to what Justice Patterson said, looking with the, why, if you just strictly look at it, why did the arbitrator say this or do this? Well, the arbitrator said, this is a minimum, but this, you can negotiate for more. And that certainly was reasonably debatable and doesn't directly conflict with the statute.
And what language, I'm sorry, what language are you specifically referring to in the arbitrator's
order?
I did not see the word minimum or
any concept. What the arbitrator said was, its purpose would appear to be to protect bargaining unit employees from losses, not additional pay sustained due to closures longer than 3 days, which obviously means they can negotiate for additional pay.
You're reading the language at page 5.
I'm reading right from the arbitrator's
opinion. Page 5 of the arbitrator's opinion.
Pardon?
You're reading the language at page 5 of the arbitrator's
opinion. Yes, page 5. Oh, and I want to say before I forget that I don't think it matters whether this statute applies to teachers, administrators only, or custodians. I think that based on the language, the statute did not prevent negotiations of this benefit. So the court doesn't really have to get into which specific employees are covered or not covered by this statute. I think the language I'm talking about is pretty clear.
How do you interpret the phrase that begins with and, the one that has been discussed today? What's the meaning of that?
I have to take another look at that. I think the purpose of that was to make clear that if people were teaching remotely or not teaching at all, they would be protected by this statute. That's what I think Anne does. It makes clear that those people are protected. But I don't, and I think that suggests that the statute doesn't even address the status of people who couldn't teach remotely and people who are actually coming into school. I don't think the statute even addresses that.
You're referring to just the subsection when you refer to
the statute? Yeah, just that subsection.
What does that subsection G do?
That's where you just talk to me from the and?
No, referring to the entire subsection.
I think the intent was to make clear that teachers who were anybody, really, who were not coming into school because school was closed, and largely teaching remotely, would be paid the same pay that they ordinarily would get.
So given that limited reading.
Say that again?
Given that limited reading, what does the phrase for any purpose mean, or does that have any use or utility or relevance in the statute?
Was that the first or second sentence of that part, but for any purpose?
That's where Justice Patterson left. School facilities remain open for any purpose and for any time lost. Now, you're reading the and for any time lost to mean that this only applies to teachers. What does for any purpose mean?
I didn't say it only applies to teachers. I think the statute applies to anybody in that situation. But there's two parts of that. One, open for any purpose. They'll be paid as if school was open, period, without wondering why or why not, or what activities might have been going on or not going on. It's to say we will treat you as if school was open, period.
What does that mean? Because it seems that what we're hearing is that it doesn't mean anything other than we're declaring the school open. But it says public school employees, broad language, covered by a collective negotiations agreement shall be entitled to compensation, benefits, and emoluments as provided in the collective negotiations agreement as if the school facilities remained open for any purpose. And yes, there's more language.
What they're saying is
I'm not in any way negating that.
We're going to pay you as if we were in normal times.
And what does that mean?
And doesn't that contradict the 2.5 times? Because the 2.5 times that the custodians get is only if the schools are not open. So if you're agreeing that here the purpose of the statute,
I think it's clear from what the legislature was doing that the schools they considered the schools to be closed.
But they say they shall be considered open for purposes of
as if schools open mean that we are going to you are entitled to be paid as if schools were not closed, but schools were closed. But that didn't prevent negotiating for additional compensation. And there's no language here when you take into account the preemption test that this court has applied starting in state versus state supervisors in all the other cases that were discussed during Mr. Oxfeld's argument, IFPTE, the other one, that in order to say that you can't negotiate for additional benefits or additional pay, there has to be a prohibition. And I might also, while we're talking about that, call your attention to what the court said in the Robbinsville case, which is at 227 New Jersey 192, page 199. And the court talks about examples of mandatory negotiable terms. It calls pay prime examples. It talks about the preeminence of pay as a quintessential term and condition of employment. So if there's anything in terms of a public policy that would be negotiable, this is it. Again, there's no prohibition.
Let me see if I can understand what you're saying. And that is, you have a...
I'm sorry.
There is a 2.5 times provision for when the schools are closed in the CBA, correct?
Yes.
And when the schools are open, it's the regular pay. It obviously varies.
Correct.
Okay. So that's the schools are open, the pay is regular. The schools are closed 2.5 times. The statute says that, and again, I want to be very precise about this, public school employees subject to covered by CNA shall be entitled to compensation, et cetera, as provided in the CNA, as if the school facilities remain open for any purpose, right? So now the legislature is saying, you're paid as if the schools are open. We go back to the CNA, which is not negated by this, and we look for the pay while the schools are open. And that's simply the
CNA said if the schools were closed because of an emergency. And as a matter of fact, that was one of the issues that was arbitrated. And the arbitrator found that schools were closed. And that was certainly reasonably debatable. And it wasn't questioned by any court, which wasn't questioned by trial court. Trial court agreed.
I'm sorry. I get all that. I get all that. But my point is that what you're saying is additional negotiation is deeming the schools closed, despite the fact that the legislature said that that the employees should be paid as if they are open. You see what I'm saying?
The legislature didn't say that schools were open. They said pay them as if they were open, which, if anything, suggests they were closed, or you wouldn't have to say that.
So as far as you're concerned, all the legislature was saying is pay them as if they're open, but you can go right back to saying we'll pay them as if they're closed.
All the legislature was saying is everybody should get what they normally would get in normal times. If somebody wanted to negotiate more, they didn't prohibit it. And if they didn't prohibit it under state versus state supervisors, it was negotiable, and the legislature set a minimum level of protection which you could negotiate more for, which made a lot of sense in this situation because these custodians were working in hazardous conditions.
I'm sorry to chop your argument.
That's okay.
But let's take a 30-minute recess, and we'll resume. Sure.